This is a podcast from wingsatliberty.com. Check out the wingsatliberty.com website where you will find more information about issues related to flying birds, learning to train birds, and events offering experiences with flighted birds. This podcast is a free service supported by the folks at organicbirdfood.com, makers of Foundation Formula Pellets, Dynamo Sprout Mixes, and Mary Medley Seed Mixes. That's www.organicbirdfood.com. Please show your support by visiting organicbirdfood.com.
This is Alternate Perspective, a Wings at Liberty podcast where we discuss issues related to free-flying birds. I'm Chris Bureau, and today I'm joined by biologist and falconer Steve Lehman. All right, we have a microphone going this time. We've gotten together several times. I wish I'd always had a microphone in the past, but this time we've actually got one going. I'm Chris Bureau. I'm sitting here with
Steve Lehman.
And we are a couple of guys that like to fly birds, and we're going to have our discussion that we've had, kind of discussion that we've had in the past. It's always been very interesting, and share it with other people this time. I'm sitting here today because of with Steve Lehman, because in flying parrots, one of the things that we run into is fear of raptor attacks. And over the years, I've had a few raptor encounters, and my guys have been successful, but there's always that possibility that we're going to run into somebody that's going to, of course, you know, be successful themselves. So my interest in learning more about how to avoid raptor attacks has had me, you know, talking to various falconers and looking for resources that would teach me a little bit about hawks and eagles and owls and so forth. And in that process, I wound up discovering that I happen to have, living fairly near me, a falconer who's not only a falconer, but he's got quite a reputation in the falconry community and gives talks all across the country. And so at some point I contacted Steve and had interesting discussion on that first contact, even just over the phone. We went out and flew our birds with Steve and his wife, and it was very interesting because during that flying the birds, our macaws and our conures, Steve had some extremely interesting observations and comments. They were different than what I'm used to. Typically, people talk about, you know, they want to ask you questions about how how you're not afraid they're going to fly or whatever, you know, fly away. And instead, Steve was making comments like, "Oh, wow, that Patagonian flies like a magpie. Look at the body shape and the wing structure." And this really was interesting to me because Steve was keyed on information and different points that I'm not used to encountering. So that had my interest really piqued in getting together more and having more discussions. And everyone we've had since has been just equally fascinating. So wanting to share that has led us here today for me. What Steve's interest in is, well, I think Steve probably can tell you that himself.
Falconry has a long history of free-flying our birds. And in the falconry community and the culture of it, somebody that is in falconry just to keep the birds and not take them out and go hunting with them, doing what the birds do naturally, really not a falconer, kind of in the strict sense of the word. And falconry has been practiced for thousands of years, and it's all about fulfilling that natural history imperative of developing a relationship with the birds and then turning them loose and participating in what they do naturally. And over the years, I've been to numbers of shows, bird shows, and seen parrots. And in college, I took some classes in operant conditioning, training rats and pigeons and things like that. And I've got a practical working knowledge of operant conditioning and some of the best examples of what can be done with operant conditioning is to look at some of the people that are handling and very skilled at handling and interacting with parrots. And I've often thought, oh, gee, why can't I do that with my own birds? And so over the last 30 years or better, I've been applying some of those classical opera conditioning techniques and concepts that you, Chris, and the parrot world have been doing a long time. And as a result of taking those concepts, I've learned a lot about my own birds, and it's enhanced my falconry.
Well, what's also happened is when we get together, because you've got this operant conditioning background with your own birds, and because I have an operant conditioning background with my birds, we're discovering we've got some common terminology and common approaches to things, which I didn't actually expect when we first got together. I thought we were going to get together and you know, I was going to pick your brain about how I could avoid hawk attacks. And to my surprise and delight, I discover we've got some of the same common problems and yeah. same interests in how we fly our birds and some of the same approaches and much, much more, even similarities in the way that we feel about our birds and our relationships, which
that's
very interesting.
Yeah, that's there's kind of a common misconception sometimes from people looking from the outside of the falconry traditions that
Not just from the outside, because I've had numerous conversations with falconers, and it's very common for them to portray and to make very clear that these are not pets. This is a hunting sport. We are not these. We don't have pets. We fly our birds for hunting purposes. And as I dig into that a little deeper, I've had some of those falconers on the side, once they get out of the public eye in that respect, admit that they have close relationships with their birds, that they do care about them. And in talking to you, I've discovered that it's quite a bit more similar than it is different.
And one of the similar areas of emotional connection that we had when you contacted me, you were interested in how to help you understand how to protect your parrots more from raptor attacks, like your conures with Cooper's hawks and some of your smaller macaws with red-tailed hawks and maybe goshawks coming through, and some of the other species that you would be flying that would be flying at higher altitudes and might be vulnerable to peregrine falcons, flying late in the evening, and what kind of threat are great horned owls?
Right, and, up at high altitudes, golden eagles.
Golden eagles. And I remember the look in your face when I was describing to you that I have the same concerns and that I worry about great horned. I'm flying goshawks, and I have two goshawks that I love dearly. Skeeter's 12 years old and Solduck's 4 years old. And when I take them out every day, I'm looking where the resident red tails are. Going late into the evening, I start to worry about great horned owls. And over the years that I've been doing this, flying the birds, I've had close association with raptors since I've been 12 years old. And over that period of time, I've had prairie falcons killed by golden eagles. I've had goshawks, killed by great horned owls in the evening, flying Cooper's hawks, and have a prairie falcon come from out of nowhere and just, my Cooper's hawks flying out across open ground, a wild prairie falcon comes in, or flying kestrels in an area where they're bigger raptors, a little kestrel, they're food for somebody else. And the risks that we take on when we go out to fulfill this natural history imperative that falconry culturally kind of not necessarily imposes, but the opportunity is there to go out and experience what goes on in the wild. There's that emotional risk.
Which is another thing that was really interesting to me and attracted me to having more conversations like this, is that the natural history part you mentioned is similar to what I feel with my birds. It's I keep parrots, but I can't keep them in small cages for me. And that's not a judgment on people that do. It's just for me, I feel like I have the ability to offer them more, and so I must. And to hear that the falconry community shares kind of a similar opinion in that way was quite a surprise to me. I didn't really expect it.
When you invited Kathy and I out to see you fly that day in the park, and I had all kinds of everybody's like this kind of preconceived or trying to imagine what it was going to be like, and who you and your wife, Susan, you know, were to be out flying your parrots. And finally I realized that, gee, you know, just relax and go out and look. And when I got there, I was just blown away seeing all those macaws, you know, flying, and then that flock of sun conures buzzing along and keeping up.
I remember your comments about it was my favorite memories of that experience was your comments about the sun conures and the high revs that were running to keep up with those macaws.
Yeah, and there was a bit of natural history going on there. There were two separate species, and there was strong instincts there to fly in a tighter flock. And you mentioned that you have seen some attempted Cooper's hawk attacks, and the little sun conures were not going to get away too far away from those great big macaws. There was some protection they could recognize being around the macaws. There was some advantage to that. And then when they would break off, some went over to the trees, but quickly the recall in that situation. It's dark in those woods. You know, they're somewhere in the deep recesses of that macaw's mind. There probably evolutionary have been some great horned owls. Whoa, gonna get back over to Chris and the rest of the flock. And it was a pleasure standing there with them landing on us and watching you and Susan. And I could see here were some people who were deeply emotionally, you know, connected to their birds. And wanted to enrich the life of them, and you're willing to take the risk that as a falconer, I take the risk every time I take them out and go hunting.
And it's not like it's just a shotgun for you to go out hunting with a falcon.
No.
This is an animal that you have a relationship with.
Yeah, my heart goes with them. And I saw that common ground. And then I don't know a lot about parrots. I've had years ago, I found it in an escape spectacle down Amazon, I think it was, and we had it for a brief period of time and found somebody that had an interest in them, and then had a sun conure that raised, and I've had friends that have worked at the Woodland Park Zoo and see their relationship with their parrots there, and it's always been in the back of my mind. And then when I met you and Susan, it was a chance to voyeuristically, you know, watch your lives.
Not just voyeuristically, because you've had some of my birds living with you for some months.
Yep.
And that's been quite fun to listen to your feedback on.
It's been, let's see, I've taken care of an Alexandra, a Blue Crown conure, and then
Senegal.
Yep. And interested in each of their personalities. They come and they've been in other people's hands secondarily before you got them. So they come with psychological, you know, baggage that comes with it and involved in our house and each of the person, and then watching them fly and trying to imagine the ecological niches that they've evolved from and look at the form and the function, the Alexandra's long center deck feather and very much like mourning doves and imagining them eating out in the open someplace and little Senegals. The way he's hanging upside down, I can see him feeding. But I'd like to know someday if this is really their natural history, hanging upside down on limbs and then quickly out into open air space. Because once they're up to speed, there isn't a Cooper's hawk out there that could catch them. You know, and the little Blue Crown, again, probably in a little more tighter forested area, a little more maneuverable.
But a little longer tail.
Longer tail. But that long, slender centered deck feather, once they're up to speed, they could outrun an exhibitor. But it's that takeoff that they need, that long tail for maneuverability.
So the long tail gives them an advantage while they're getting up to speed.
Yeah, it dissipates from some of the science, it seems to indicate that helps dissipate some of those vortices coming off the body. It allows them to accelerate really quickly. And all the different species of parrots you have here in the big free flight enclosures, looks like, and I see, you know, watch the species interact. And I've had the privilege of, when you're out of town, take care of your birds in the big free flight facility. And walking in there and seeing all of them, and I have a little bit of a biology background, and trying to imagine, you know, where they come from around the world. And
A little bit of a biology background?
No, a little. I'm not a good scientist. I've got a degree in zoology, but I'm not a good scientist. I never want to. I'm curious about things like this.
A little modest.
Yeah. Well, but it's been a real privilege to be around you and opening your home up and seeing the way you live, and yeah, it's been really fun.
Well, the conversations that we've had have been just absolutely fascinating to me, and every time we have one, I'm just kicking myself that I didn't have the microphone on. In fact, even as we're sitting down here today, I didn't have the microphone on, and I'm just regretting that as well. But anyway, we've had a lot of fun already. One of the things we wanted to go over here today was covering some of the... Well, first off, you know, before we actually go into any kind of topics, give me just a little bit of a background on your background, just, you know,
okay,
your education and experience that way.
Okay. I've been at this since the 60s, and a little kid growing up in eastern Washington out in the desert, and at that time there were no regulations on having wildlife as pets, and so I can thankfully say that, you know, over the course of those years, none of the ravens and magpies and none of the species I interacted with are threatened or endangered. And it was kind of, I had a great, really, really great parents that allowed me to have wildlife close at hand. And then my interest in falconry, just, you know, a little boy looking at a National Geographic and imagining what it would be like to have a hawk that would hunt with you. And great parents would, you know, help me read books and start to experiment. And the first hawks that I successfully hunted with was a red-tailed hawk hunting rabbits. And then just a whole world opens up, because it's kind of an ecological portal, a very realistic one.
Yeah, because not only do you have to learn about the red-tailed hawk, but you also have to learn about the rabbits.
Yeah.
You have to learn about the habitat. Relationship that they have, the effect of habitat on those animals.
Yep. And all the cultural things that were on at that time, everybody shot hawks. Even the Department of Wildlife had bounties on them. And these were birds that I would emotionally I could identify with them for whatever reason. And so I was very determined to, you know, have people stop shooting them, and worried about my own birds that I hunted with, and saw that cultural and philosophic and scientific shift, that the predators have a natural place in the world, and laws were passed, and now they're, you know, protected all over the United States and internationally. And falconry is a highly regulated sport, in which, you know, you just can't go do it. You have to have a sponsor. You have to have take tests and inspections of facilities, and have mentors to, you know, introduce, you know, somebody into the sport. And
but it's not that way in Europe, I understand.
No, but there's a strong tradition in Europe to have mentors. There's this kind of hierarchical, you know, the kings and queens and,
sure,
you know, that sort of thing.
Well, there's obviously there's some benefit for having somebody with greater experience.
That's to bought help, and there's a natural tendency to seek people out. They'll know more.
Which is what we're doing right here, right now. I'm looking for information about
and
hawks and so forth.
And the reason I'm here taking my time out of the day is, one, we have a great time. I enjoy being around your parrots. And in your really, you know, effort to take that next step and learn and participate more in the natural history, you know, the flight and what it takes to do it and all of the challenges, especially in your situation where you're flying the prey.
Right. Well, what's interesting about that when you say that is that, you know, I look for different resources to learn from. For many years, my time spent on the free flight list and helping other people learn what I know has taught me a lot about my own. I mean, I've learned more for myself not knowing it by having to describe and focus on what I've done and alter what I've done to match what I've discussed. I've learned a lot, but at the same time, there are elements that I have no experience in, and I'm finding that there's not a lot of people to go to in the parrot community that have the kind of information that I'm looking for. And if they do have it, they're not necessarily always open to sharing it. And I didn't expect to run into that to a more openness of that in the falconry community. What I expected initially was, can I just glean some information about hawks and so I can protect my birds from hawks? But what I've discovered, kind of to my surprise and delight, is that not only do we have some common interests, but we also have a common philosophy that makes it so that we have much to share beyond, I have a lot to learn from your experience and the falconry experience as well. You know, when I started doing this back in 1993, I've been making it up on my own for the most part, and I've learned a lot in doing so. But at the same time, what I've discovered is that the falconry group, who of course has been doing this for thousands of years, have a lot of the stuff I've figured out in my short time in doing this, but they've refined it in different ways. They've got, you know, there's terminology for a lot of the stuff that I'm messing with, and there's a great deal of information to be learned from the falconry group if we can make that connection and not be alienated from each other as two opposing views,
like predator and prey. Yeah,
exactly. So that's what's been really fun about this talking.
Yeah, and it has been fun. The conversations that we've had over the last months have just been about a year now.
Yeah.
It's been absolutely fascinating. And philosophic issues, looking at free flight from looking at raising juveniles and bringing through that process of flying and flying free as compared to juveniles that are raised, and maybe when we get them, they haven't had any free flight experience. How do we make that transition into free flying them? Or individuals like the little son Conyer, he'd been 5 or 6 years, he was 5 or 6 years old, and the only place he'd ever flown is in a house, and most of the time and in a cage with a very loving lady that was just becoming elderly, and she was very concerned about the future. And Kathy and I took that little son coming, we call Jama, just in a transition so we could help her find a home for her. And
fell in love with it, didn't you?
Yeah, kind of. just kind of gradually kind of worked her, his or her, I don't know the sex, but into our lives. And that's the, just like with my hawks, you look at hawks as having this predatory drive, and they're not social and that sort of thing. Each of them have their own individual personalities. Each species are different. Male and female are different. And knowing that the natural history background is so important. And that's what you and I share in common, is that your parrots are dear to you, as are my hawks. Falconry for me is not just, or not necessarily, a hunting sport, but it's a natural history sport. In the process of doing it, we learn so much about the natural history. And then knowing the natural history and the biology of the birds in the wild, bringing that information into that personal relationship that we have with them.
Right. So it's not just a sport, or it's not just an act. Training birds is not just an act, whether it's falcon or whether it's hawk
or whether
it's parrot.
Yeah, that's right.
It's not just about operant conditioning. It is also about the ethology, the natural history.
Yeah.
And all of those elements come together, and the more we understand about those elements, all of those elements, the better we're going to be at keeping our birds out there safe.
Yeah. And the thing I really liked about what I saw with you and Susan is the same thing that Kathy and I, and we've raised 4 kids and we've got grandkids now, is having the hawks in our lives and flocks of pigeons and my chickens and all
those
things.
That's right. You got free range, truly free range chickens.
Yeah.
And you're a falconer and have hawks and falcons on your property all the time too. That's an interesting combination.
And like what I saw in your lifestyle, and like in ours, it's the falconry for me, it's not just falconry, it's a natural history lifestyle. My interests are go not beyond, but include, it's not just the interpersonal relationship I have with them, but it's the natural history, the greater context.
Right, which is, I think I think what you're touching on is the same thing that causes people to yearn to fly their parrots. They understand that they're designed to be out there free and flying and exercising and having all this great fun that we see them having when they're flying. And to not have them out there kind of defies their natural history. And that's...
It limits the total experience.
Right.
One of the things I noticed that we walked into the parking lot that day when we first met you, you had the parrots in the truck and dog kennels, and they were there, and I could hear all the clamor, and not knowing all the talking going on, there was a lot of communication going on, not just between you and the parrots, but between each of the parrots that was going on. And when they got out, there was such an exuberance that just...
They burst into the air.
And the vocalization that changed. And I see that with my hawks and falcons when I fly them. They're part of my daily life. I try to pattern it like it would be in the wild. It's a time to take a bath, and it's time to get time to preen. And all of these, knowing these patterns of preparation before they go out and hunt. I imagine the same thing happening with parrots. They get up someplace where they've been asleep at night, and the food supply is miles away. And time to get a drink, time to socialize, and then to take that risky flight over unknown jungles and forests and deserts someplace to go to a water hole where the predators are waiting, or to a food supply where there's these competition between flocks of parrots or what's going on. And I saw all of that in your parrots when you turn them loose. Because I experienced that with my own hawks, when I take them out and turn them loose.
I see. That's part of what makes our conversations to me so fascinating. Is that your observations are coming from a completely different base than what I'm used to hearing people talk about. You know, a lot of the people that are in free flight today haven't been doing it a great deal of time. This is a fairly new activity, flying parrots outside. At least for the public, and there's not a lot of natural history in the conversations about how we're flying the birds. So to hear your natural history take on it and your observations of their, how their shape or in their body configuration fits into their natural or potentially fits into their natural lifestyle, and how that impacts keeping them as pets flying, that's just fascinating.
Yeah, and there's some in the parrot culture, the people that have them, there's such a rich variety, not just in color and sound and shape.
Well, it's like 350 species of parrots.
Yeah,
so yeah. There's a fair amount of them.
Yeah,
and from all parts of the world, different climates. Yeah. Not all parrots are coming from the jungle like people think. Some of them live up in the mountains in the snow. I mean, and often people think of, the kea as a bird that lives up in the snow, but people often forget that macaws live up in the Andes in Bolivia.
And when you told me that, just
flying around in the snow. Yeah. That's just normal routine for macaws.
I love your website and the one photograph of the big, beautiful macaw with the snowy background. And
it's not unnatural as people think. Yeah. People have this mental image of them being tropical birds, but the macaws up in the Andes. I mean, when Bob Bailey mentioned that, we were fortunate enough to have dinner with Bob Bailey at one point, and we were talking about this, and he was talking about how he had these, he was responsible for all these parrots that they were training, and they had this big facility, and he was in Bolivia, and he's up in the mountains, and it's snowing, and there's snow on the ground, and there's macaws flying around, and he's thinking, and I'm paying how much every month on a utility bill to heat that building? Yeah. He went home and basically turned it off, but, he was standing up there looking around going, macaws in the snow. This is an everyday natural occurrence for some of these birds. So... it's not to, it just adds an element to when we're thinking about parrots and their natural environment. There's a lot to think about.
Yeah, and in the story of that first parrot with Jean, free flying him and by himself, and I realized that I was there was a danger involved, because looking at his shape and his behavior, he's a flock bird, and by himself, being vulnerable. And then when I see your flock of 8 to 12, you know, St. Conyers that you have, it was a really neat thing you did to be able to pull that off, raise all those kids at the same time, and then introduce them as a flock.
I have to say 8 was a bit much to do at one time.
Yeah.
We have a total of 12, and we raised 8 at one time, and that was pushing our limits as far as social
interaction. But the advantage that gave them, each of them individually, is a result of bringing them along as a flock to turn loose. That's part of the natural history. I don't know St. Conyers, but I would guess in the wild, the pairs are nesting a bit apart, you know, and they've got their territories, but then they form some sort of super flock, you know, young to get together with the adults, and there's a more eyes to keep an eye on.
They actually fly a little bit like starlings when you watch them fly.
Yeah.
They're kind of this swarm, dodging and darting as they fly, where some of the other conures don't dodge and dart quite as much, like the mitrids, for instance. When I watch them fly as a group, they're more like blue angels flying around.
When I watch your flock of conures with the big macaws that time, then go home and flip on the History Channel and hear this school of fish changing. The evolutionary counterpart in the water, in the air, St. Conyers, and some species of fish, and that fly.
That's St. Conyers. They're just dodging and darting, and they never fly in a straight path for very long. They may start out for a straight path for a short distance, but when they're actually flying flying out over that field, for instance, they have got this kind of up and down and sideways, and they never, you know, they kind of take the long way. To wherever it is they're going,
and
they're bouncing around.
For that peregrine falcon that came out of nowhere, it's a tough target to bring into your line of sight.
And I guess if you're bright yellow, you need that kind of
maneuvering. It was just great fun. Great fun.
It's I can say that part of the reason why we did the flock was having our conversations and your discussion of the safety and numbers thing, which I had known in the past because I'd had a small flock of mitrid conures that flew together and were quite successful. But we were very concerned about our little snicket, our little sun conure, and all four of them, actually. And so we decided to go ahead and give it a shot and let's just see what this is like. You know, what's it going to be like to have 12 sun conures? I mean, body mass wise and expense wise, it's no different buying a macaw. You just got to broke it up into little parts.
Yeah.
12 times the fun of snuggling.
And as I watched, you know, when I would come by and see at different stages of development and the process of you getting ready to fly them, in fall tournament, when young hawks are raised, there are several different ways of doing it. There's imprinting, so they have a very close human association with the person raising them. And then another, which they're raised just in a social situation, but you don't hand the food to them. So they don't develop a sibling relationship or a direct parental relationship, and to avoid some of the aggression problems that might occur, and then the food, real loud food begging. Some of the raptors, when they're food begging, just drive you nuts. And they're in that relationship. And then there are others, lots of raptors are being domestically raised and to be raised with their parents. So there's no human association whatsoever. And then getting them when they're fully flighted and then training just as if they were a wild hawk. And then bring him into that falconry environment and turn him loose. And what I was curious about, because someday I would like to have my own flock of, haven't determined quite yet the species of parrot I'd like to have a flock of, and was that they were socially tuned in to you and Susan, as well as all of the, without a good benchmark for myself, what they looked like in the wild, but I think there was pretty accurate. What I'm seeing is a very natural interrelationship between the individuals within the flock and yourself. And the dynamics of it, even though you're earthbound, You're a part of the flock, and their willingness to go out, come back, and socialize and preen. They're arguing with each other, and they're arguing back. And next thing I know, I have a sun conure laying upside down in my pocket. Another one's trying to destroy the threads on my shirt, and this one then comes in and displaced by another one, doesn't like me giving the attention, and comes in. A little squawky little thing goes on, and one flies off, and all of that behavior going on, I would, in my mind's eye, if I could fly and be wherever they're in their natural habitat, that's what would be going on. Hanging upside down on this and that and interacting and having the privileged point of view that you and Susan provided me because of you raising them in your home, that's part of it. And they're willing to interact with me in the same way they were interacting with their own kind. That for me, that's what falconry provides me, is a privileged point of view about nature that as a biologist I could stay out in the wild, and I've done it with binoculars and try to understand what's going on. But what it allows us to do is to because of our relationships that can be formed, we can get these insights
that you can't get because you can't follow them around in the wild the same way you can have.
We can with radio transmitters and good field biology and taking that information. And what's going to be exciting for those of you who are free flying your parrots is going and visiting the places where they are in the wild, looking at the birds in those wild settings, and looking and interpreting the behavior in your own birds.
What's funny it's not just fun to see them in the wild that way, just in watching the movie Polly, for instance.
What was that?
Watching the movie Polly. The movie Polly,
I haven't seen
a blue crown conure. Okay? And here I have had blue crown conures and know them fairly well.
Oh, is that the one?
And Polly talks.
Yes, yeah.
To see the personality of Polly, I had at the time a blue crown conure named Willow, and to see Willow's personality wasn't just, that's one of the reasons why I think they did such a great job with that movie, was they didn't just take and stuff this little bird into the movie someplace in the script. They actually incorporated the bird's personality in the way that they photograph, you know, their videoing of that bird or their filming of that bird. They actually incorporated a great deal of the bird's natural personality that I know from my own blue crown conures. And it was a very, very interesting take on the movie because of the personality that I knew from my own birds. So to go out and observe, I mean, if this will do this to me in watching a silly movie, think about what that'll do for you when you get to go out and watch the wild birds. You're going to have insight into the personality of that bird in the wild that no static observer is ever going to have. You're going to know things. You're going to recognize things.
A very famous biologist by the name of Tom Cade, incredible biologist, a neat person in his own right. I'll paraphrase him here. And he said that falconry is just a very sophisticated form of bird watching.
That's exactly, and parrots are the same thing. I would say exactly that keeping parrots.
But the direction you're going in your relationship with your parrots and you know, leaping into, you know, this into the free flight, the same thing is happening.
Well, what I'm doing is that hasn't happened yet a lot in the bird world. I have a frog in my throat here. Anyway, is I'm trying to round out their education, basically. You know, by starting to fly them, we've made a step in the direction of giving them some of their natural history back, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But until you actually round out their flight skills and round out the kind of exposure to the natural world that they would have in the wild, then you've not really completed that process. So that's basically what I've been working towards without necessarily realizing it, I guess you could say. But that is what's kind of been driving me, is getting them to their full potential.
You know,
and some of that comes from a fear of hawks, but some of it also comes from just seeing the way that the birds love interacting with the natural elements, the landscape and so forth, and developing those additional skills.
And an observation here that over the years, handling my hawks and eagles and owls that I've hunted with. I've always thought it was about taking them out and hunting with them. But they have a social life. And friends of mine, Don Berry and a friend of mine, Wally English, they were years ago at the Woodland Park Zoo, they were handling the citizens there. And I would go with them and see them interacting with them and also in their homes. And I always wished that I could have those kinds of relationships with my raptors. And I thought they were different. And one of the things that I had the opportunity to do is that developing some conditioning exercises at home with my hawks to give them, you know, just like an athlete that plays football, he also lifts weights and does cardio and aerobic behaviors and exercises and that. So behaviorally, I do those things with my hawks, but I always thought other hawks. But then watching the ones you view in the parrot community, that close relationship, then I begin to realize that in the wild, I've seen bald eagles, pairs of bald eagles sitting on snags together and interacting and calling, peregrine falcons and prairie falcons and pairs of red-tailed that will hold down a territory all winter long. And there was a social component to it. So what I started to do is, instead of looking at operant conditioning, I took a page out of the parrot world. Instead of interacting with my predators thinking that it's all prey drive, there's a social component that was involved. And I let myself open to those possibilities. And I found that they really do have a lot of those social, they know who I am. They know the clothes that I wear. They could recognize me no matter what I wear.
Well, not only can they recognize you, just to beat your drum here a little bit, so people understand that you've actually taken this concept of using various reinforcers rather than just food reinforcement or weight management.
Yeah.
I believe you've had a goshawk that's been loose 10 and a half months, totally on its own, but would come hunt you down, come find you to go out and go hunting.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that, because that's an interesting story.
Skeeter and I've hunted together for 12 years, and over that period of time, I've developed a way to be able to turn him loose, go out hunting with him in the evening. Instead of catching something in the evening, I'll let him go to roost, and then in the morning, I'll go find him, and then continue the hunt in the morning. And he learns to go to roost, and then the next time I do it, I don't show up as soon. So when he comes looking for me and he finds me, then we start to hunt. So I've had him loose for a week and 2 weeks at a time. And something I've always wanted to do was to have that relationship be one that goes for months. And in 07, starting in January, I had a radio transmitter on him, and he had me in one of those loose, and then the radio transmitter quit. And days went by that I didn't see him. And I was looking all over the place, and I finally had to calm myself down. The anxiety, you know, just like you do with your parrots. And
sure.
those of you here listening to this, you can understand the anxiety that's involved after such a long relationship. And I finally went, I know he can catch food on his own. He has that capacity to do that. And if I can, I know the relationship we have is more than just food. That if I quit just looking for him, he'll come here. Maybe all the time I've been out looking for him, he's been at the house trying to get my attention. I haven't been there. So I stopped doing that. And sure enough, I walked outside, and there he is, sitting up over the pond in a big alder with his gray breast toward the house. And I don't think that was any accident. That's the way they make themselves. He could hide in the woods and just disappear with these blue, black, and white eye stripe and just melts into the shadows. And there he is out on a limb like that. And I'm all excited. I was going in to get my bag with my lure and call him down to see if I could even get him down. And I just called myself and I said, I've seen that behavior before. And I looked at him and I said, he wants to go hunting. So instead of calling him down, I turned my dogs loose and off we went, and we caught a rabbit. And he let me make in on him when he was on the rabbit, and then I transferred it up on my glove and let him eat all of the rabbit that he wanted, just like he would in the wild or when we'd been hunting for all those years. And he had a full crop, and you jump up onto a limb, and I turned around and walked home. And the relationship after that, for months afterwards, was that if he wanted my attention, he would come in and either perch in that tree or perch on my truck, or his favorite thing to do was come in and chase my chickens. He wouldn't kill the chickens. He'd just make them squawk.
Yeah, he would make some noise. To let you know.
And Kathy would...
ring the doorbell.
Ring the door. And Kathy would say, Skeeter's home. Skeeter wants you, Steve. And you hear this chicken squawking and go out, and he'd be sitting on the telephone pole or whatever. And then I had to decide whether I had the time to go hunting or not. And I've got work and life to do, and he's got his. And sorry, Skeeter, I just don't have time. And so I get on my truck and go to work or what I need to do, and then he would go out and catch his own food. And sometimes he would be gone for a week, 10 days at a time, that he would have to catch things on his own. And then...
I'm sure was an education for Skeeter as well, because I'm sure that hunting with you turns out to be more successful.
And that's where the intelligence comes in terms of shaping and primary and secondary reinforcers that we've had the long conversations about. Weight management, just like a hawk in the wild, they know where the best hunting places are, and where those places in the environment. When he catches a rabbit, great horned owls, when they hear the rabbit squeal, that signal, that sound that the rabbit makes, isn't to warn other rabbits. It's to let every coyote in hearing distance and every owl in hearing distance come over and get this goshawk off me. All right? And I know he's intelligent enough to figure this out, that when he's with me, a wild red tail or a great horned owl have never come in on him, or a coyote's never shown up. And I feel really certain one of the reasons he shows up is that when I go out and hunt with him, he gets a meal uninterrupted. And
he's actually got somebody helping him go hunting. So yep. Teamwork is.
And then there have been times when he would show up to go hunting. I wouldn't turn the dogs loose, and I would just walk out and stand still, and he would sit there and wait. And then he realized that I wasn't going to help him make it easier, and then he would go off and hunt on his own, and I'd follow him through the woods as he would hunt woodpeckers, and he would catch rabbits on his own. And one thing he would do with the neighbors, he would stalk the neighbor's place late in the evening and catch rats around their bird feeder. And he would literally stalk up there and then sit perfectly still and let the rats go far enough out into the open where the bird seeds would fall under the feeder. And he had to get there in time before they made the ferns that grow up around the base of the house.
And they got past their safety zone.
Yeah.
And he knew that safety distance.
So falconry is a privileged point of view to be able to follow literally a wild goshawk like that.
That's
and then come down, and then when springtime came, he set up a territory in the woods right next to the house. And one day I went out to hunt with him, and he caught his rabbit, and he jumped off, and he started courting me. And I handed him some food, and he just packed it off, and he flew to the woods. The first time he's ever flown away with any food around me. And then the next morning I get up and I've got my cup of coffee in hand, and I'm walking outside and I look up and I, wow, what is that? I've never seen it. It was Skeeter. He looked like a cross between a seagull and a marsh hawk in his courtship flight over the house. And within a week or so, there was a wild female goshawk that was in there that he was courting, and he would come to the house. And it was kind of funny. He would court me, but he wouldn't come to my, I could call him down to my fist to eat. So he'd come in and he would see me and he'd want to court. And so I'd just throw the food to him. He'd grab it and he'd take it back in the woods. And I could hear him courting the wild female goshawk back in the woods. And she stuck around for about 10 days, left to go to Canada, just some, you know.
Passing through.
Real guy that's, you know, with a really good, really good meal. it was an awesome experience.
Well, I see. That's another thing that has me very interested in having these conversations with Steve Lehman like this, is that he's doing some things that the rest of the falconry community hasn't quite caught on how to do yet.
Over the centuries, you know, there have been things like this that have happened. A hack, for example, the concept of raising young hawks and falcons, and on a platform. It's the way the peregrine falcons have been reintroduced back into many parts of the United States, understanding the natural history. Young falcons, even though they don't have their parents with them, can be taken to a nest ledge or an artificial structure and then food delivered every day. And then as they reach that point of fledging, they take off and they have a strong sense of fidelity to the nest site and coming back to where they're being fed.
Which is what we do with our baby birds. It's one of my platforms for how I train my birds is using that strong that strong drive to return and help not get lost.
Yep.
That's what I like to describe
and
it as.
There's some very good friends of mine, falconers, that are way better practitioners of the sport than myself. They have an unbelievable relationship with their falcons. And we were talking about weight management and that sort of thing. The routine and the synchronicity of their life is such that it comes time in the afternoon and live in great environments where they can take their birds out and hunt them. And the falcon's just hungry. And it's now time to get something to eat. Not unlike a horse that's in a pasture and you know it's hungry, you turn it out, it goes out and grazes and does what a horse does.
Right.
And they turn their peregrines loose and they go out and hunt partridge and grouse.
And that's not exactly weight management. Which, by the way, your 10 and a half months of Skeeter flying loose wasn't exactly weight management either.
Yeah, but
food management,
food
maybe.
Weight management. He managed me. He was in total control. And over the years, I'd like to think that trying to understand that natural history of the relationship and the long traditions that falconry have provided, you know, in terms of the historical record and how to do it, are there. And it's the subtleties and nuances that are so fun. And
this is where we share. This is some of that common ground. Is that not only do we have an interest in flying birds, but we also have a common interest in observing the natural elements that make it work. And I like to tell people that I don't train birds. What I do is I simply set them up to succeed so that they can train themselves by putting them into selected environments where they can learn the next skills that they need to learn.
Yeah.
But I'm not really training them. They are training themselves. Yeah. I'm just arranging the environment so that they can learn without getting lost in the process.
And there are other situations you were talking about, weight or appetite management, in terms of motivation. When the hungrier are, the more highly motivated they are. And in our falconry situation, many times we'll get the birds and they're in the wild or they've come from somebody else and they don't trust me. There's fear involved, the unknown. And then in terms of motivation, always I like to put them on a scale and weigh them every day. I keep a record of that. And the weights at which they'll fly and hunt can vary a lot based upon muscle development. So I try to do a lot of supplementary exercise so I get the muscle mass up. And when they've got an engine, so to speak, that's a V8, their need for gas is a lot greater than if they've got a little four-cylinder. So my opportunities to create training situations when they're really muscled up requires more food, gives me a chance for a primary reinforcer to react with them. But at the same time is that I'm now in my falconry, I'm not so much interested in recall. I know how to do that, to get them to come back or how to get them to hunt. It's the behavioral topography of all of the other emotions that they have. And the behaviors when they're in a particular emotional context, let's say they're relaxed, they're not into hunting, what are the kinds of things that we'll do? What kinds of things can I do for them? Or are they willing to ask me to do? Do they want something to drink? I need to provide water for them. They want to sunbathe. They're in a situation where they can't get it. They can give me a cue and I'll put them out and sunbathe. And those kinds of things will gradually break down the distrust and the potential of fear, where I have to use more weight management to bridge those fears they might have.
So by relying on those other interests, those natural interests, what some people might call drives, take a moment here and recognize that there are different languages that we speak when we're talking about training subjects. You've got the operant conditioning set of terminology and definitions
Very
of
powerful.
How to use the language. Mm-hmm. You've got ethology. You've got the common English language, the way everyday people speak about various subjects. And each of these languages has their various uses, including the anthropomorphic concepts to some degree. You have to be careful how you use each one of those. Yeah. Operant conditioning doesn't have all the answers. You can't discuss every subject to complete clarity just using operant conditioning. And you can't discuss every subject just using mythology. Yep. So you use each of these to your advantage. So if I say drives, I'm not trying to veer off from operant conditioning. I'm just using the language that's available that can help get a concept across. And drives, food drive, play drive, sex drive, survival, social drives, those are some of the subjects, some of the interests, inherent interests that animal comes with. And you're using some of those, not just the food drive.
And you know, you touched on one. It just kind of rolled off your tongue, and then we went right around about my mind fixed. And it was the anthropomorphic one. And because of my modest science background, that's kind of dangerous grounds to go on. But what I found is, as the years have gone on, is that those same kind of emotions I would hold for my kids and my wife and my friends create an emotional awareness of their needs and the things that I can do for them in those social interactions. And I found that when I gave in to my anthropomorphic tendencies that I've resisted over the years from doing, that I found that my relationship with my birds improved.
Well, it makes a certain amount of sense to me.
In people with parrots or people with pet dogs, there's a criticism, oh, they're just treating them like kids. Being around the parents, because the parents, the social quality, listen to the way people talk to their birds, touch them, that anthropomorphic quality. I used to be rather critical of that, or kind of snicker, with my hawks, I don't have those same feelings and emotion. But live with a goshawk for 12 years. Or with my little soul duck that I have right now, the other male goshawk. And I found that when I...
Obviously, there's a limit to using anthropomorphic terminology and discussions.
That's right.
But it has some value.
But the value is a heightened emotional sense that allows us to be more open to intuition sometimes.
This is
coming from someone who I'm constantly checking that anthropomorphic thing, because it can lead to some intense caring. And that's what I noticed when Kathy and I visited with you and Susan. It was the intense caring that goes on for the birds. And those of you who are listening to this and wondering whether in your lifestyle or where you live, whether you with the birds that you have and the caring that you have for them, whether it's worthwhile to take that risk to do free flying. And if you choose not to, for whatever the reasons are, because of the intense emotional relationship they have with your birds, not wanting to take that risk, that's very valid.
Of course. It's like the concept that if you bring up this discussion of pets and with a falconer, in many cases, the whole they kind of bluster on you and get a bit frustrated. They don't like to be
anthropomorphic thing.
They don't want to be told that they have a pet relationship with their birds, and they certainly don't want anybody to think they do. And part of that's because of the climate of our government's relationship with keeping falcons and hawks as hunting sport. But I tell you, I would suggest that if you have a rifle to go hunting with, you don't have anywhere near the emotional connection with that rifle as what you do with an animal that you have interaction with. So there's a very strong and very real emotional content.
Yep. And in the time that I spend at home with them on the days that I'm not hunting, or that part of the day that we're not out flying and hunting, it's become very interesting and very personal, because in the wild they have those same kinds of relationships. With the hawks, they may be separated a bit. You know, they're not flying around in flocks, except for maybe the case of harris hawks. They'll socially hunt, but the elements are there. And what's so enjoyable about the parrots is that social quality to them. And when I see you fly your birds, they're sticking around because they like you and Susan. And when they get tired, they don't go and rest in the trees or whatever. They come back and rest on your car and your truck. And that is a type of recall. And with some of my hawks and falcons, like the case of Skeeter, it's like that. And when the day comes to an end, I think of a story that my son told about his good buddy Ryan and the red tail that he was flying. It was a bird that he caught out of the wild and trained. When the sun went down, her name was Cyclone. She'd fly all the way back to the truck and literally, body language wise, would you open the truck so I can get in the truck? You know, she knew what it's like to sleep at night with great horned owls stalking her at night, and she wanted to spend the night in the truck. And that was a wild hawk soliciting human beings, cross species. You know, who's anthropomorphizing here? There was the hawk to them.
Right.
There's no imprinting involved. She was looking at them as, you know, kind of almost like a flock of red tails or whatever it was, to go home. And then they would get home and she would sit on the back of a chair, and they were in college, and they would party. And Cyclone was part of that environment. So she was bringing a bit of natural history in the wild with red tails that they do. You'll find places where there's farmers mowing a field and there are 10, 15 red tails out there dumpster diving for Microtus and windrows of alfalfa. And they're sitting on the telephone poles burping, right, with full crops. And they're not flying away from each other. Nobody's attacking each other.
And they don't normally hang out in social groups. Right? So.
But remember their eyesight. A half mile away or a mile away can be very close.
Right.
And those body languages and levels of tolerance are being played out. And then when springtime comes and mate selection comes, now they're very close. And they're raising kids, and there's a social unit in the nest and all of the manifestations of that. And then at some point they become solitary hunters, but not all of them do. There are some hawks out there that especially the big females that make their living going around, oh, there's a male red tail just caught something and he can't fly off of that. I'm going to go take it from him. And a friend of mine watching golden eagle in golden eagles in Wyoming, there was a male golden eagle. He spent most of his day feeding three female golden eagles before he ever got anything to eat. He'd catch something, one of the big females would come over and take it away from him. And then he'd fly and hunt again, and the other females would sit and wait until he catch them, and another female would come over and take it away. By the end of the day, he finally get to eat something himself.
Huh, interesting.
So they look solitary up, but there's these social things that are going on. And goshawks are known for being, you know, these solitary forest creatures that are sneaking, floating through the woods, and with tripwired sort of personalities to catch and catch things and eat them. And my son did some work in Wyoming where they had radio transmitters on. They had seven goshawks in this one little valley. And they're secretive enough, you might see one at a time and assume that's all there was there. And there were adult male goshawks that were sharing a pheasant that one of them had caught and killed, but the others who were sitting there waiting, it was a big enough meal for all of them. One would take off and the other one jumped down and eat. And so the things that that you're so fortunate to be able to share, and the rest of you are listening to this with your parrots, that social interaction as humans that we crave, and we look for different ways to either replace it, demonstrate it, to enjoy it in our lives. I can appreciate that because I've opened myself up for that, and with my hawks, I can have that relationship, and it's one of those things I really enjoy a lot.
To me, there's nothing. Nothing to compare with taking the birds out and turning them loose in a spectacular environment. Some places
like
just beautiful.
Where you're have, someday I'm going to come in and visit you.
Standing up there on one of those cliffs, and you've got this stunning view. The birds take off and play on the wind.
Yeah.
You're watching them slope soaring in the breeze. The wind coming up off the cliffs, and then they come back and they dance on the wind as they're trying to land on your arm, and they could go someplace else. They could go do something else, but they don't want to. They want to come back and play with
you. The one shot of the macaw right on the edge, and where the wind was hitting the edge, and then there was an eddy, and he would stick his head out into it, whoop, and go and land, tail up and down, and then they're out there on the wind blowing. And then the next sequence, they're all back at the truck where there isn't any wind blowing.
Right. You know, to that's go. The that's the YouTube video. Flying Fisher Valley.
Yeah.
That end sequence there. Which is really fascinating to watch them fly in the wind like that.
And I see my hawks when I take them out in a big wide open area. And when they're learning to fly and negotiate and literally feel their way through those air currents and see that play behavior. And I see it with my hawks, especially the young hawks that I raised and then I turn them loose at hack. And in the morning, the last male goshawk that I hacked, it was Solduck. And in the morning, first thing he does is he gets up in the morning. We wake up to chickens squawking. He's chasing chickens around and pine cones and playing and grabbing pine cones. Then he takes off. And the chickens know that he's not going to kill and eat them. And the roosters that are dominant, the dominant roosters, they walk out into our yard. And the hawk make passes at him. And he's the bull and they're the matador. And they're making these fake playful passes, and the chickens are, hackles are up, and they're jumping in the air, and they're running and kind of in fear and back, and all the hens are sitting back in the brush watching all this, and then the goshawk loses, the play behavior, loses interest in that, and flies off to start playing with pine cones, and then comes by the house and food begs, and I'm gonna get up, fix my coffee. And then I notice all the hens, the roosters that stayed out there and took on this terrible mean, dangerous hawk, they come out and solicit these roosters. And those are the ones the hens allow them to copulate with, or the ones that are out there taking on the hawk.
Playing this game.
Right. No wonder the senoritas throw flowers to the matadors in the ring.
It's a common behavior even amongst parrots or even amongst falcons or hawks and chickens.
Yeah,
it's not just about the matador.
It's taking the risk. Being on the edge of that cliff when I watch that pair, it's taking that risk, and they thrive on it.
Well, an interesting point about flying the birds up there real quick is that, the way we progress, the way we teach the birds to get to that level, to where we're flying at what we call level 5 locations on a scale of 0 to 5, 0 being an indoor enclosure, 5 being a location where you've got 0 recovery potential. In other words, if you lose them, you can't do anything to go get them. They have to come back on their own. There is nothing you can do about it. So on a 0 to 5 scale like that, the progression that we use to get to that level 5, one of the things that's kind of interesting about that is that when we start flying at a level 1 outdoor location, where we first go outside, where there is some risk of the bird just flying away, that is probably the most scary part in this entire process. And the reason why that's the most scary is because we have no history. We don't know what the animal's going to do. So by the time I master a level 1 location, which would be a wide open field where there's no obstructions to view or no obstructions to my physical ability to follow the bird, and we start progressing to the level 2, level 3, and level 4, each of those steps is made with a greater degree of confidence than what I had the first time I turned them loose outside. So where some people might think that we're just taking them out there and tossing them loose at the top of a canyon, we're not. There's a sequence that goes in, that's involved in getting them to that level. And the fear factor, the concern I have over losing them, continues to go down as we go up the chain, up the scale.
Similar thing happens in falconry, and depending on the level of understanding and where the bird is, it's called a crean, it's just a long line. Flying the birds from point A to point B and making sure that all those behavioral benchmarks are being met before they're turned loose. And some of the birds we have to do that with, a lot in managing the degree of hunger that's involved to take those before they're turned loose first time. Other birds that we bring along, and I can see in the relationship that I have with them, I don't, even the birds that are wild, I never put them on the crayons. But another bird that I'll have a relationship with, I can see whatever I've done wrong, and they're trust-wise, I haven't been able, they may be trained, but we haven't developed the trust and the companionship quite yet. And so I'll put them on the crayons and fly back and forth, and that degree of anxiety, I always listen to that inner voice.
That inner voice is just critical.
Yeah.
I've gotten to the point now where if I'm driving along the freeway and the thought comes into my mind, you check the oil lately? I'll pull a truck over, get off on the side of the road, check the oil on the side of the freeway. Because that little voice, that inner voice, is absolutely critical to listen to it. And that's just a question in your mind.
Yeah. And the loss, accidents, all those things are there. And it's Murphy's live and well every time I turn them loose.
And that's another point, is that, you know, even though I've got birds that I feel are I'm quite comfortable taking them up to a level 5 location and flying them there, that is no guarantee that I'm not going to lose them. It's preparation to help them have the maximum skills, the maximum physical fitness, the maximum ability to navigate and orient themselves. It's the maximum skills I can develop in them helps me have a greater degree of confidence in them, but there's no guarantees. There's always the possibility that something's going to spook them, or they just get it in their mind, you know, I wonder what's way the hell over there on the other side of that canyon. And now I got to wait for them for who knows how long until they decide they're ready to have an interest in coming back. They have minds of their own.
Yep. And that's the part that's so fascinating.
That's what makes it fun in a way.
Yeah.
As much as I try to avoid those situations, they are what gives it some actual reality. It's just like a reality TV show that I get to be the star of. You know, when I'm out there in my little world playing with birds flying on the top of a cliff, I get to be the star of this reality show that is just unbelievable.
Those videos are just great.
Well, I'm not talking about for other people. I'm thinking about it for me.
Well,
you know, I get to be out there doing this adventure that is incredible. Well, I think this has been a fascinating discussion. I've enjoyed it, and I look forward to the next one. We're going to try to get together again in the future here, and we're probably going to, I think we're going to discuss some more of the common ground that we have as falconer and parrot keepers. And I appreciate you taking the time to sit here and spend this time with me.
Thanks for having me. We always have a great time.
If you have questions or comments about something you heard during this podcast, please contact me through the Wings at Liberty website. That is www.wingsatliberty.com. Special thanks to Steve Lehman, Kathy Lehman, and Susan Hilliard for their support in helping make this podcast happen. I'm Chris Bureau. Thanks for joining us.
This has been a podcast from wingsatliberty.com. This podcast was produced by Chris Bureau, all rights reserved.